Hello, and welcome to the Jacobite Podcast. Episode 11, Interlude. So, we return to England this week, where we will quickly catch up with the end of the Highland War and the Williamite War in Ireland to see what events were like in England from 1689, and then we will give a relatively brief run through the reigns of King William and Queen Mary, as well as events across the Channel with the Jacobite court in exile. Since 1689, William of Orange and his wife Mary Stuart were officially installed as King William III and Queen Mary II of England, and also given the crown of Scotland. Whilst William was away fighting in Ireland, Queen Mary was often in command and running the affairs of state, and by account of most historians was a wise and capable ruler, albeit one who deferred to her husband when he was able to return to rule. William and his military forces had soundly defeated the Jacobites in Scotland and Ireland, but despite overwhelming support in England, there were still a number of English Jacobites. A group of Jacobite sympathising nobles wrote to James in December 1690. Presumably some of these were the same lords whose entreaties might have reached James while he was in Ireland before the Battle of the Boyne. On this later occasion, however, the man chosen to deliver the petition to James was John Ashton, the former court clerk to Mary of Modena. Ashton was arrested en route and the petition was discovered. John Ashton was tried and sentenced to death, being hanged in January 1691. Despite the modern conception of the Catholic Jacobite in the popular imagination, Ashton was actually a Protestant, who opposed the way that deposing a king had been considered a simple matter for Parliament. He felt the country had been fatally weakened, and it was under such an external threat, the only remedy that would set the country right again was the restoration of King James to his throne. John Ashton's final words were put into a pamphlet to rally support for the Jacobite cause, and King James showed appreciation for the man who many declared a Jacobite martyr in the only way he had left, by declaring Ashton's surviving son a baronet. Speaking of King James, since his defeat at the Boyne and his army's defeat at Outram, he'd retreated into his borrowed accommodation at Saint-Germain, using his court followers and hangers-on to establish what would constitute a government in exile. James became a very pious man, making pilgrimages to La Trappe, a monastery 80 miles outside of Paris. James had taken on a more contemplative and philosophical mood, starting to write down his thoughts and musings of life to his point. Published in Paris in 1692 as his Royal Meditations, James felt that in his view, his people had not only turned their backs on their sovereign, but in doing so, had forsaken God himself. His writings talk seemingly of martyrdom of Christ and comparing his deposition from the throne in a similar trial. James reasoned that if he devoted himself to God, possibly gaining penance for his own sins, as well as the sins of his nation, he could restore himself to the throne. Ultimately, if this was not God's will, he could at least save his own immortal soul. James's day-to-day life at Saint-Germain consisted of prayer, meditation on theology, riding on hunts, and exercising. There was a bright spark or two to be had in life in exile for James, as in 1692, he celebrated the birth of another child, a baby girl named Louisa Mary, in honour of King Louis XIV of France. James then received what he thought would be his second lifeline. France was going to sponsor another invasion of England to reinstall King James to his throne. Louis moved forces to Nantes and rallied ships so that he could utilise current French naval dominance of the Channel to further disrupt the Grand Alliance and cause trouble for King William on his own doorstep. The plan was to land James on the Scottish coast at the head of around 30,000 troops. The newly landed Jacobite army would then link up with Northern English sympathisers and, in an ideal world, sweep to London and regain his crown. But in an absolute worst-case scenario, James and his Jacobite forces were going to at least cause enough trouble in England that William might take his eye off the ball of Europe long enough to allow Louis and the French army to further their own aims on the continent. All that was needed was for the French to smash past the English Royal Navy. In preparation for his arrival, James issued a declaration to be sent to England and read to his subjects. In this document, James claims that England was deluded into following the Prince of Orange, taking part in a revolt that led to an illegal coup deposing their rightful king. Now, James didn't blame his subjects for this. He instead claimed they were duped and lied to by William. James believed that the most severe punishment God could mete out to the English people was denying them their God-given sovereign, himself. This would mean once the English realised this, they'd beg for him to come back and take his divinely mandated kingdom. James also offered a general pardon to all of his subjects, bar the lords who defected from him, the entire village of Faversham, and any court in the land, including its officers and judges, if they convicted or executed any Jacobites. In all likelihood, James probably felt he was being extremely magnanimous. He was egged on by his advisor Melfort, the man who helped draft the declaration, as well as others within his exiled royal court, to offer no quarter to his opponents. This was in direct opposition to a faction of Jacobites back in England who were dubbed the Compounders. The Compounders favoured James returning to the throne, but they felt it was inevitable he would have to make some level of accommodation or compromise to his opponents. Hoping that there would be some sort of compromise that could at least make James more palatable, the Compounders were horrified by the content of this declaration, and they even went to the extent of printing their own forgery of the declaration with far more lenient terms, offering a full pardon to the English people, save for four lords who they considered to be the ringleaders of the insurrection, and an extra tax cut thrown in to sweeten the pot. Queen Mary, on the other hand, made absolutely sure her father's true declaration was seen by ordering the publication of said declaration, with her own scathing commentary rebutting each of James's points with a great deal of sarcasm attached. Now, even with this public relations disaster, there was still a chance that James and his Jacobite forces could overwhelm William on land and seize power. All it would need is for the French Navy to sweep aside the Royal Navy, and James could still pose a massive threat. And so it was that a French armada of 47 ships, under the command of the Comte de Tourville and le Marquis de Bellefonds, the Marshal of France, set sail and was eventually spotted by the Royal Navy off the coast of France near Bellefleur. Told by James to expect English ships to defect to the Jacobites, the French were left sorely disappointed in this regard. A considerable naval battle was fought to a stalemate, but the English pursued the French as they disengaged to return to port. Several of these ships docked in the port at Le Hoc. The English fleet chased the French into harbour, disembarked, and assaulted the ships in port, destroying a dozen of them. The English came to call this the Battle of Le Hoc, a military engagement that left the French Navy, for the time being, neutralised as a threat to William's forces. It's been said that James had somewhat mixed reactions to the news. He was both sad at his attempt to take back his throne was failing, but somewhat heartened that the navy he'd helped create managed to hold its own against France. With the naval defeat, the Jacobites were again forced underground. As Daniel Defoe had said, many would now stay at home, drink for him, swear for him, rail and snarl at those they dare not oppose. Another method of recognition designed as a form of secret code for fellow Jacobite travellers was to adopt a limp when entering sympathetic taverns, the limp being code for initials of each member of the Jacobite faction. L for Louis of France, I for Jacobus, the Latin spelling of Jacobus for King James, M for Mary of Modena, and P for Prince of Wales, James Francis Edward Stuart. The Jacobite underground in England is believed to have been up to 1 in 6 in the population, a sizeable amount. It was enough people hostile to the King and Queen to make the regime in London nervous. This government had managed to sweep James and his administration aside fairly quickly. They feared just how quickly a counter-reformation and Stuart restoration could take place. It was therefore felt by this new Williamite regime that they should sharply crack down on any dissent to prevent that from happening. In 1691, the Crown and its administration had already removed nearly 400 bishops from the Church of England. Their crime was to refuse to swear allegiance to William and Mary, as they felt God had invested James on the throne and that they had sworn an oath to him as king as long as they or he lived. At this time, there also developed a frostiness in the relationship between William, Mary, and Princess Anne. Anne's friend and confidant, Sarah Churchill, was married, funnily enough, to John Churchill, Lord Marlborough. Marlborough had tried to cover his own backside in the case of a Jacobite restoration, and even though he'd been one of the first defections that had helped to end James's reign, he begged forgiveness and sent correspondence to Saint-Germain. In these letters, Marlborough not only informed them of English troop movements, but also alerted James to when English Jacobites were in danger of being caught. Marlborough was eventually arrested for this and locked in the Tower of London until 1694, when he provided certain accusatory letters that were proved to be forgeries, which proved his innocence. Ironically, Marlborough still continued to pass information to the Jacobites, including a planned English attack on Brest, which led to many English deaths, including Thomas Tolmash, one of the Williamite officers who distinguished himself at the Battle of Otrim. Princess Anne was slow to forgive William and Mary. While she remained cold towards her sister, she became positively vicious about King William. She was known to refer to him as Caliban, after the beast in Shakespeare's Tempest, and even more brutally, as the Dutch abortion. She would often appear at court with Sarah Churchill by her side, in an open show of support and a public snub to her sister and her brother-in-law. Mary would publicly upbraid and berate her younger sister, whom she felt had become estranged from her due to some form of divine punishment on Mary for violating the divine commandment of honouring thy father and thy mother. Nonetheless, William and Mary ruled very well together and managed a competent administration. Despite originally being paired together in what was clearly a political marriage, the couple did seem genuinely affectionate for one another and had developed into a stable partnership. Mary was a competent and able queen who would hold the levers of power during William's overseas commands of the army, but always deferred to William as per the gender conventions of the age. Mary might have been a joint monarch, but it was clear William was going to call the shots. To take military matters for a moment, it's safe to say that things had taken a turn for the worst since William's forces had forced the Jacobites into a surrender at Otrim. In 1692 at Steenkirk, the French army had defeated William's and killed or wounded 8,000 soldiers, including Major General Hugh Mackay, the commander who'd faced Bonnie Dundee at Killiecrankie and personally led his men into the fight in Ireland. William's war on the continent was becoming more and more costly in terms of both lives and money, a point that was reinforced by another English defeat at Landen, in which the Dutch Blue Guards commander, the Count of Solms, was killed. Interestingly to note, it's also at Landen that we lost Patrick Sarsfield, the Earl of Lucan, and the last major military Jacobite commander in Ireland, who was fighting for the French. Parliament had to massively increase expenditure on the war, which was beginning to turn against William and the Grand Alliance of which he was a member. Taxes had been raised in order to fund these campaigns, and they were a major part of fundraising, but the state had also resorted to lotteries to raise funds, as they didn't require the approval of any creditors they already had, most of whom were put off of the progress of the war and the fact that England's new monarchs were already struggling with debt to lend them any more money. William therefore decided to attempt some financial reform for the nation in the long term. He authorised Charles Montague, his Lord of the Treasury, to establish a central bank for the country for lending and financial management. And as it was in 1694, the charter was established for the Bank of England, the long-term aim of which was to establish a firm financial footing for the country and to provide centralised borrowing for those requiring funds. All of this was completely overshadowed by a seismic shift in the nation, as on December 28, 1694, Queen Mary II died after contracting smallpox at the age of 32. William was said to be distraught, and though some cynics believed it was because Mary's death removed the legitimacy of William's claim to the throne over James, William, in all honesty, appeared to be in a state of shock and desolation at the loss of his wife, even saying to Gilbert Burnett that he was the miserablest creature on earth. Queen Mary was buried on March 5th, 1695, after a frozen winter lying in state at the banqueting house in Whitehall. In a ceremony costing £50,000, a huge amount for the time, the entirety of Westminster Abbey was draped in black, and composer Henry Purcell composed music especially for the service. People throughout the nation mourned the Queen, with both Houses of Parliament turning out to the funeral, along with the public who wished to mark the passing of a beloved and well-regarded monarch. Jacobites, on the other hand, had previously proclaimed Mary as Goneril, the oldest daughter of King Lear, portrayed as a greedy character desiring only land and power in Shakespeare's tragedy. To a Jacobite, Mary being struck down was due to her disloyalty to her father, inciting divine punishment. In Bristol, it was said church bells rang and the famous Jacobite song, "When the King Enjoys His Own Again," was sung. Despite this Jacobite gloating, in general, there was a lot of goodwill towards Mary, less so towards William, who had a reputation for being cold, distant, and aloof. It was also felt he was using English money and resources to help aid the defence of his Dutch homeland. Discontent with William had grown to the point that one man felt determined to act. Sir George Berkeley, one of Bonnie Dundee's officers, who'd served with Viscount Dundee at Killiecrankie, arrived in London in January 1696 from Saint-Germain on promise of forces ready to rise. When Berkeley arrived, however, he discovered the Jacobite forces in England were woefully lacking in numbers and resources, and therefore commenced his own recruitment drive. Bolstered by the arrival of the Duke of Berwick, James's son, who'd been smuggled into the country under heavy disguise, the Jacobites held a masquerade ball, drank toasts to the king, and swore their loyalty. However, the majority of English Jacobites swore they would not raise a finger until there was obvious military support from the French, including invading troops to support a domestic uprising. Berkeley and Robert Charnock eventually decided to cut through all the red tape of an invasion and just assassinate King William. Around 40 fellow Jacobites drew up a plan to ambush William whilst he was out hunting in Richmond Park, and once they dealt with his guards, King William would be killed, either by bullet or by sabre. The day picked by the plotters was February 15th, 1696, with a backup date of February 22nd if William chose to skip a week's hunt. The problem was that the plan unravelled for the plotters 2 days beforehand, when on February 23rd Thomas Prendergast was recruited into the gang, most likely with Berkeley telling him what he'd told all the others, and this was assassination carried out by the select number that had received the blessing of King James. Prendergast was horrified. Not only was regicide being considered the best way to make progress, but that plotters would claim King James would ever give his okay to this. Prendergast went immediately to William's trusted friend and confidant, William Bentinck, the Earl of Portland. We haven't mentioned him much in this podcast, if at all, but Bentinck has been with William all the way through since 1675, when he stayed with William of Orange and nursed him through his fight with smallpox. Since that show of devotion, Bentinck would hold a special place in William's heart and confidence. So much so that Jacobites and several historians since have alleged that there may have been a full homosexual relationship, but in truth there's very little evidence to confirm this. It is in this podcaster's humble opinion that this Jacobite smear campaign might have been a calculated one to feed into certain prejudices of the era against LGBT people in most areas of society. Bentinck immediately told William of the assassination plan, which had been confirmed by intelligence from other sources. William feigned illness and did not hunt on February 15th, which raised no immediate eyebrows or alarms in particular. But when he missed the 22nd, the plotters were beside themselves with worry and fear that the plot was discovered, and they would, of course, be right. On February 24th, 1696, King William announced to Parliament that there was an attempt on his life being planned. Hundreds of suspected Jacobites were arrested, and several ringleaders were executed. This plot did a fair amount of damage to the standing of the Jacobite movement. People such as the diarist John Evelyn balked at the idea of assassination and French invasion plots. Having the king's son, the Duke of Berwick, present in the country and associating with some of the plotters didn't exactly help matters. Sir George Berkeley managed to escape and head to France, where James initially refused to see him, with a fellow Jacobite, Thomas Aylesbury, claiming that James had detested what had been attempted in his name. This botched assassination plot allowed the English Whig Party to try and curry favour with King William by introducing the 1696 Bond of Association, where all in public life would have to proclaim their loyalty to King William III, the right and lawful monarch. This has been described as Whig opportunism, given that they sought to try and marginalise the Tory party in Parliament, many of whom saw William as a king of convenience until a Protestant Stuart, such as Anne or her son, were able to take the throne, given that the English crown was to revert to them on William's death. Interestingly, William himself was quite ambivalent about the association, given his early days of playing Whig and Tory off against each other for his own benefit. Eventually, William chose to rely on the Whigs and a group of five lords known as the Junto, after the Spanish word for council. The Bond of Association achieved the Whigs' desired response, as 113 MPs, 20 Lords, 104 Deputy Lieutenants, 86 Justices of the Peace and a Lord Lieutenant were all eventually forced to leave their posts for refusing to take the oath. These removals helped boost numbers loyal to the regime. Thousands would sign copies of the Association, which was circulated around the nation. Some had worried that William would be pushed aside as a foreigner, for there were some who still wanted to find an English candidate for the crown, but as a Protestant protecting England from the threat of a possible Catholic autocracy, William was the current safest pair of hands. William was given a further boost in May 1697, when France, which, like England, was financially suffering from the war and had also reportedly suffered from famines, agreed to enter into peace talks. These talks were held in the town of Ryswick, just outside The Hague. A letter of protest came from Saint-Germain to the negotiating parties, then drafted by King James on June the 8th, 1697. In this letter, James argues that apart from being deposed, he now also had to watch his country enter an unjust war. Taking aim at the talks, James argued that by negotiating with William, the crown heads of Europe were tacitly endorsing this coup and legitimising William as the usurper of his throne. James demanded he be restored to his throne, his envoys be received at the peace talks, and that he be consulted on any decision to be reached with England. Much to his chagrin, he was ignored. A blatant snub and a hard dose of reality as to how hard James had fallen in European standing. In September 1697, the Treaty of Ryswick was signed. Its major provisions were that Louis returned several conquered territories and recognised William as king. There was also a provision that Louis stopped supporting, either directly or indirectly, groups looking to overthrow the government in London, Edinburgh or Dublin. James was crushed. Given that Louis XIV was his biggest supporter and patron, the fact that he moved to backing William as king was devastating to any attempt at a restoration. Louis offered James an olive branch by offering to recognise James Francis Edward Stuart as the true king when the time came, but in all honesty, this must have come across as a rather hollow offer to James. He must have seen the writing on the wall by now. The people of England celebrated the cessation of hostilities with fireworks and cheers of God bless King William. But in truth, most of the ruling class were under no illusion that the Treaty of Ryswick was probably just a stopgap measure for all of its participants. As such, the unconditional support for the king was short-lived. Parliament began to flex its muscles. It started not only by selling off the long-argued-over confiscated lands of the Irish Jacobites, raising money that was already spent on that war, but by forcing through the Disarming Act to cut the standing army of the country, even in the face of staunch opposition from King William. William felt this was a foolish law, given the army would be essential to stem potential French aggression from the looming issue of the Spanish royal succession. But armies were expensive to maintain, and Parliament still held that niggling fear in the back of its mind that any monarch who had a sizeable standing army might have the temptation to use it. If a monarch were to impose their will using an army, it would complete the slide back into complete autocracy. King William begrudgingly signed the Disarming Act into law, giving royal assent to the bill on February 1st, 1699, albeit with a speech informing Parliament he felt this legislation was ill thought out, ill timed, and left the country vulnerable and dangerously underdefended. 1700 proved to be a year of many different crises. The first came in March, when Scottish colonists departed from the Isthmus of Panama in an event that is known to modern history as the Darien Scheme. Despite most of my focus being on England this episode, things hadn't stood still in Scotland. The ravages of the Highland War and public backlash to the massacre of Glencoe, the latter event being blamed on King William and the Scottish government in equal measure, had taken their toll on Scotland, but the nation had carried on under the new management of those siding with King William. But this new government had to contend with famines, in which thousands died from lack of staple crops and a loss of livestock due to loss of feed. As well as the lost food, there were several disease outbreaks that cost lives, as well as the economic losses suffered by merchants whose ships were unable to go to their trading partners in Holland and France thanks to the War of the Grand Alliance. Scotland at this point was still, of course, legally and politically distinct from the English. That showed in their level of ambition in 1696, when Sir William Paterson got an act passed through the Scottish Parliament creating the Scottish Darien Trading Company, with a monopoly to trade goods in the East for Scotland. The aim of the Darien Company was to create a trading enterprise on a par with England's East India Company, the trading behemoth that worked with the English state to trade in India and would later rule India as a private colonising corporation. Scots flocked to invest and join the settlement set up in Panama. In 1698, ships took Paterson and 1,200 Scots to establish a colony. One small issue arose, however, in that the land was already under Spanish occupation, and they were far from happy that there was a new interloper trying to take over their colonial territory. The Scots' goods of wool and whiskey didn't find any takers, and the colonists not only lived under fear of constant attack from Spanish forts, but also lost the majority of their settlers to diseases such as malaria and yellow fever, which were unknown to the Scottish immune system. Sir William Paterson himself even lost his wife and child to illness. One of the final nails in the coffin, though, was that King William explicitly forbade English citizens or businesses to trade or assist the Darien colony, following protests from the board of the East India Company, as well as a keen desire on the part of William to avoid offending Spain, one of his key European allies at the time. In all honesty, William was probably never going to have backed this attempt at Scottish imperialism and colonial expansion, but the snub hurt. By the time all was said and done, and the last of the ships limped home, the Scottish nobility had lost nearly a fifth of all the funds in circulation in Scotland, leaving the Edinburgh administration reliant on funds from the Crown and from England. Scotland was still independent, but it was vulnerable, its finances and standing critically weakened by the failure of the Darien scheme. There would be consequences to this action, and the resulting actions taken would have ramifications for Scotland, England, and the Jacobite movement. 1700 also marked two important deaths that caused the upheaval of not just England and Scotland, but all of Europe. The first was the death of Princess Anne's son William, the young Duke of Gloucester, on July 30th at the age of 11, due to severe fevers and bleeding. His mother Anne was heartbroken, having suffered 6 miscarriages before the birth of William and 10 children die after his birth. Anne stayed in seclusion, as was the royal custom, for the burial service at Westminster Abbey on August the 9th. As distraught as Anne was over her son's death, it's fairly certain that William felt similarly. The Duke of Gloucester would have continued for a long reign of Protestant monarchs for England. With young William no longer with him, King William had to try to secure a Protestant lineage to the English crown, plus someone able to have a decent ally to further Dutch interests. Somebody ended up blowing the dust off one of previous recommendations of William and pronounced Anne as the heir presumptive before settling the line of succession for the English crown on the head of the Electress of Hanover, Sophia, and all of her descendants. The Hanoverians were a Lutheran European royal family from an area of modern-day Germany. Sophia was the granddaughter of King James I of England and 6th of Scotland. This established her and her descendants with a royal pedigree palatable to the English, as they were Stuarts, but there were other Stuarts and other relatives who had a closer claim to the crown, being descended from Charles I. But since they were Catholic, the Lutheran Hanoverians were a far more palatable alternative, which prevented James Francis Edward Stuart from taking control of the throne on William's death, so Parliament was all for it. In 1701, they passed the Act of Settlement, enshrining this line of succession in law, even to the present day. James wrote from Saint-Germain to encourage the Duchess of Savoy to register a complaint and try to claim her place in line, but to no avail. The Act limited the declaration of war to parliamentary approval, as well as the Crown having to seek Parliament's approval to leave the country to go abroad, a jab at William's constant excursions back to the Netherlands. The Act attempted to shut the door on any future Jacobite claims, but international politics pried that one open again, as well as the fact that the Act helped to stoke a lot of domestic tension, given that the English did not consult the Scottish legislature when they passed this matter. On November 1st, 1700, King Charles II of Spain died, leaving an empty and contended throne in a strategically vital nation. King Louis XIV of France seized the opportunity to declare his grandson Philip, Duke of Anjou, as Philip V of Spain. This was anathema to England and Holland, as they supported Charles, the son of the Holy Roman Emperor Leopold. England also opposed any possible union between France and Spain, which at this point they believed to be a real possibility. despite that possible union being in blatant violation of several international treaties forbidding such a move. In addition to this, news had reached England that when William III died, Louis XIV and the French had said they would support the claim of James II's son, installing James Francis Edward Stuart as James III, a blatant violation of the Treaty of Ryswick. This little revelation had in fact come from a letter from the Duke of Melfort, in what one could argue another instance of his politicking being more trouble than it was worth. To the anti-French faction in Parliament, this proved Louis had no intention of sticking to any agreement and should not be trusted with regards to keeping to his word. Both sides prepared for war, which would start in earnest in Italy in 1701. It is, however, time for us to bid farewell to our two warring kings, as both will have been lost by the end of 1702. James II, former King of England, Scotland and Ireland, continued to live his quasi-monastic life at Saint-Germain, performing royal duties and receiving visitors. He even went so far as to touch holy medals to give people as a traditional cure to scrofula, a lymph node infection known as the King's Evil, treated by a monarch's touch, even by proxy. The court in exile helps raise his son as the Jacobite Prince of Wales, as well as a future king in waiting. The young James Francis would often tell court visitors that he would be welcomed home one day by loving supporters. Such was his fervent self-belief in his right to rule. James lived out a morose but steady existence until September 17th, 1701, when he died of a second stroke that year, with his son at his side and his cousin Louis XIV swearing an oath to him on his deathbed that James Francis Edward Stuart would be King James III of England and 8th of Scotland. James's mortal remains were laid to rest at the Church of the English Benedictines in Paris, save for his heart, which was sent to a convent in Chaillot, his flesh to a convent in Paris, his entrails divided between Saint-Germain and Omer, and his brain was sent to the Scots College in Paris. James was a man who refused compromise and believed in his divine right to rule. He had indeed been usurped in a coup, but his inflexibility, the rampant anti-Catholicism in England at the time, and constant issues with military logistics and troop numbers meant he was unable to wage effective campaign to retake his throne. James died with his dreams of retaking his kingdom unrealised, but with a son who held a claim and the support of his French cousin Louis, the flame of the Jacobite movement he'd started was still burning strong. If King William ever celebrated this final victory of sorts over his uncle and father-in-law, it wasn't recorded, and his victory would prove to be short-lived, as William would die within 6 months of James. On February 21st, 1702, King William was thrown from his horse while out riding in Richmond Park. He suffered a broken collarbone, but seemed otherwise okay, until March 3rd, 1702, when he collapsed whilst at home in Kensington, before finally succumbing to pneumonia on March 8th, 1702. William was buried in Westminster Abbey, but reactions to his death ranged from few mourners in Worcester, short a sorrow in Bath, all the way to expressions of joy in Buckinghamshire. Given that it was said William's horse was thrown after stumbling on a molehill, Jacobites often expressed their celebration of William's end by drinking a toast to the mole who dug the hill, or as they put it, a toast to the gentleman in the black velvet. William was nowhere near as popular as his wife Mary, and historians have not on the whole been kind to him on a personal level, noting his cold, somewhat distant personality, as well as emphasising the fact that he was Dutch, and therefore was he really an English king? Personally, when it comes to William, I'm quite divided. Was he a good king? Well, that's sort of a subjective question that's open to interpretation, but he seemed to fulfil the wishes of the English at the time, who were searching for a Protestant royal king linked to the Stuarts to help them unseat James. But unlike prior historians who portray William as an aloof foreigner, it doesn't really matter to me that he was Dutch. Rather, it bothers me more that William clearly saw England and its resources as something to be used to further the interests of Holland and to further his own military ventures in Europe. Not to mention the fact that he hardly ever bothered with Scotland and Ireland, bar recruiting men for his army or fighting Jacobite forces in those theatres of conflict. I can safely say at this point, I feel I wouldn't have chose either William or James as monarch, and that whilst it can be argued that William and the so-called Glorious Revolution helped lay the foundations of our modern constitutional monarchy and the parliamentary democracy we have, it did so on the back of a very morally and legally dubious coup d'etat. Next time, we shall see the start of two reigns, that of Queen Anne of England, Scotland and Ireland, and of the Jacobite King James III of England and 8th of Scotland. These two would prepare to secure their kingdoms against one another and continue the fight of the English, Scots and Irish administrations under the Protestant Stuarts against the forces of Jacobitism.